Little Deaths is Emma Flint's debut novel, a blend of literary fiction and true crime. It has attracted a lot of praise and been longlisted for a slew of awards, including the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger. It's a skillful retelling of a crime that shocked 1960s America. The case remains unsolved, and many of the issues it raised remain as unresolved now as they did then, as I discovered when Emma joined me to discuss the book.
It's based on a true story, and it's set in 1960s New York. My main character is a attractive single cocktail waitress who's bringing up two very young children on her own, having separated from her husband. She wakes up one morning, very hot, sweltering July morning, to find that the children are missing from their bedroom.
I mean, obviously you're from the UK, and it was a crime that happened before you were born, I'd expect. Yeah. So what attracted you to this particular story?
Two things, really. I read about it when I was about 15, I think. I used to want to be a pathologist, and I was obsessed with true crime when I was young. And I first read about the story about 20 years before I started writing the book. And the two things that stuck with me through those 20 years were, firstly, the image of the character who became Ruth Malone. She's this tiny, petite, slim, very attractive, very striking woman, heavy makeup, red hair. And in all the photographs, she's surrounded by men, big, bulky men in suits, police uniforms, lawyers, detectives. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was, when she was interviewed by the police about the last evening and night before the children were taken, she said that she fed them veal and green beans for dinner, and that's not what they found during the autopsy. And I kept thinking, that's such a strange thing to lie about. Of all the things that she could have lied about, why would she lie about that? Because that didn't give her an alibi, didn't get her off the hook. And I thought, whatever the reason for that lie, I have to find a solution to it in whatever I write.
People have written about the case in the past. I think your book is the 10th, and yet you clearly have managed to bring new light to bear on this unsolved case.
Thank you. I wasn't actually aware that there had been 9 others. I deliberately didn't read any other fiction about it before I wrote the book because I didn't want to be influenced by other people's interpretation of the stories. So I read the non-fiction books about the case, which were written by journalists, and obviously I read the newspaper reports, the trial transcripts. I think what's fascinating about it is that there was a lot of doubt around the case. It took 3 trials to get Alice Crimmins, who was the name of the original Ruth Malone character, it took 3 trials to get her convicted and sentenced and in prison. And it seemed to me when I read the evidence that the police fixed on her as a suspect right from the beginning, before they really knew that the children were even dead. So I think any case where there's a little bit of doubt, where it's not cut and dried, and where there's no confession, is always going to attract attention, writers, retellings, ideas about what might have actually happened. And I think, or I hope, what I'm bringing to it is, as you said at the beginning, a lot of the themes that I raise in the book, how women are perceived, how women are judged by how they look, they are issues that I think we're still facing now. If you look at the way that Amanda Knox, Kate McCann were judged, these are women who have been associated with crimes, and they've been judged on their behaviour, on their sexual behaviour, on how much makeup they wear, on how they dress, not on the actual hard forensic evidence surrounding the cases that they were involved with. So I think at the level of crimes, there's still something relevant going on. And there's clearly still a debate raging about how women are judged on how they look and how they dress. I mean, there was a headline not that long ago showing Theresa May and Nicola Sturgeon, and the headline was Lexit, because they were both wearing skirts. That's the kind of headline I would expect to see 50 years ago, and it's still going on. I just find it extraordinary.
The case is definitely very much a case of trial by public opinion. I mean, that two lines that really stuck with me are Ruth's lawyer's comment that she's the very picture of a scandalous woman, and the chief investigating policeman saying he can smell guilt on her like cheap perfume.
My sense of Ruth was that she was judged, even before the children went missing, she was judged because she has separated from her husband, which is very unusual for the time and the neighbourhood that she lives in. This is suburban Queens. This isn't cosmopolitan Manhattan. This is well before feminism reached the suburbs. She's married to her high school sweetheart, and she lives in a fairly conventional blue-collar neighbourhood. And she's separated from her husband. One of the neighbours says he didn't even hit her. You know, she just wasn't happy. So she's a single mother, but she's not staying home to bring up her kids. She's going out to work. She's going out to work in a bar. When I read about Alice Crimmins, I kept hearing, the question I kept hearing was, how dare she? How dare she want more than to be married with kids? How dare she want more than to stay at home? How dare she? How dare she? That's what I kept hearing. I kept hearing it implied by the newspaper articles. I kept hearing it quoted in some of the non-fiction books that I read. The neighbours were judging her. The press were judging her. The police, in my novel, the police turn up at her door. She's fully dressed. She's wearing makeup. She's wearing her usual mask of makeup. And she smells of brandy because she's had some brandy for the shock because her children have disappeared. And immediately they think she doesn't look the way a grieving mother should look. So she becomes a suspect. And that's the sense that I got when I read the real accounts of the case. There's one reporter who claims when he turned up at the house just after the children had gone missing, he claims that he heard the investigating officer say to his colleague, "The bitch did it." And that was before they knew there'd been a murder. I think that's an extraordinary basis for an investigation, never mind a story.
It certainly gives Ruth in the book no chance of establishing her innocence, and it's left to the character of Pete Warnocky, a junior reporter who's very much an idealist, to try and establish her innocence. Is he a fictional creation?
He is a fictional creation. He's completely fictional, although most of the sources for the story were newspaper reports, so I did obviously use those as the basis for his character. What I find interesting about Pete is, as you said, he's an idealist, and he starts out wanting to write the truth and wanting to make his break in journalism by finding out who really killed the kids. And then he's told by his editor, no, what you need to do is write the story that people want to read, which means you need to give them a monster, you need to give them some sex appeal, you need to play up the money angle, if there's a money angle. And he's pretty horrified by this cold-blooded way of breaking down the truth. He watches Ruth and he decides that he's going to try and work out the truth for himself. But the problem is, as he watches her, he falls under her spell and he becomes completely obsessed. He can't see it himself, and it blinds his judgment. And I found his character interesting because as a writer, but also as a reader, his character continued to surprise me as I was writing. He starts out thinking that he's going to be Ruth's saviour, and actually all through the book he judges her as much as any of the other characters do. And it's almost worse because he's blind to it. He thinks he's doing it for good reasons, and he condemns the others. He condemns the policemen and the other newspapers who are so hard on her, and he can't see that his own judgment of her is just as subjective, just as objectifying.
And Queens is itself another character in the book. Did you have a very strong sense of New York of that time? Did you do a lot of research?
I did do a lot of research. I deliberately didn't go to New York while I was writing the book because I didn't want to see New York in the 21st century. I wanted to see suburban Queens through the photographs of the time, especially the photographs that were taken by that are in the non-fiction books that look at the actual street and the actual house, the actual apartment block where the children lived. And I think lots of people have said that they really felt that the setting was very vivid and very real. And American readers have said that to me too, which is amazing considering that I'm not American. And if that's the case, I think it's probably because I grew up in a suburb on the edge of a city, Newcastle, which is obviously not like New York or Manhattan. But I think when you grow up in a quiet suburb where there's a sense of claustrophobia, there's a sense of homogeneous community where everybody is watching one another. So where I grew up, it was a great place to live as a child. But I do remember if somebody new moved into the street, you would know, you know, not even an hour, you would know if they were married, if they had kids, if they had any pets, where they worked, what kind of car they drove. And that sense of being watched, that sense of houses close together, people not having anything to do but gossip about their neighbours, that's what I wanted to bring to the novel, because I think that sense of being watched and that claustrophobia is really important in the sense of the story, but also in the sense of Ruth Malone, what she's rebelling against, what she's pushing back against.
And certainly you seem fascinated by what happens to characters when great pressure is put upon them, where their breaking point lies, where love turns to obsession or whatever.
Hugely interested in crime. I read crime fiction, I read true crime. I've always read that from being sort of 12, 13. And I think what interests me about it is that when you have a murder, everybody who's involved in that murder, the perpetrator, the investigators, the victims, families, friends, suspects, they are all placed under the most enormous pressure that I imagine you can put a human being under. And that makes people behave in surprising and unexpected and, for a novelist, really interesting ways. I also think what fascinates me about crime is that, I was talking to someone about this just today, we've all had those moments of rage or blind, being out of control. And what fascinates me is, for me, and I would imagine, I hope, 99.9% of the population, we get a bit angry, we might, you know, kick something, and then we move on. What interests me is the 0.01% of people who don't move on, who take that rage and do something really destructive with it, and who merge that rage with planning or greed or lust and commit a really revolting crime. I'm also interested in the kind of mind that can conceal a crime after the fact, particularly in a very ordinary community. I remember reading about the West case in the 90s, where you had a house in a street, very ordinary street in Gloucester, looked like thousands and thousands of other houses around England, and the most horrendous evil things were happening in that house. And, you know, the journalists were interviewing the neighbours and saying, well, yeah, they were a bit odd, but they were just like any other couple. And I think what fascinates me is this ability to cover it up and appear normal. I can understand the blind rage. I can't understand the meticulous planning and the lying. That's what fascinates me.
Did you feel that bringing some kind of closure, even if it's fictional closure, in Little Deaths was important?
Yeah, I did. I spent 6 years writing the book, and I think I needed a conclusion at the end of that period. But I also think it's very unfair to ask a reader to invest in victims, suspects, main characters, narrators, and not give them a resolution. And I felt that the real case, the resolution wasn't particularly satisfactory, partly because, as I said, she had three trials before she went to prison. But also, I think, because the real Alice Grimmins has never talked about the case publicly, it does give you a bit of leeway to interpret how she was feeling, what those years in prison must have been like for her.
The audiobook that I listened to flowed beautifully, and I wondered if maybe you read your work back to yourself, because it certainly reads very well out loud.
Yes, I'm very proud to say that I've read every single word aloud before it went to my editor. I think even though most of my readers will have it on the page and will have their own voice hearing it, it's really important to me that it flows properly, that the rhythm of the words is right, that the prose just sounds right. And I'm very particular about that. That's probably my biggest obsession in writing. It has to be absolutely right. The rhythm of the lines has to be absolutely right. And I can sit for a very long time poring over a single word that isn't right and come back to it 3 or 4 years later and realise why it's not right.
Have you listened to the audiobook yourself?
I have. I was very lucky in that I got to hear samples of the narrator's voices before it was confirmed, so I got to say yes to them. And I think it's fabulous that there's two narrators, that they've kept it male and female. It was really important to me, obviously, that they were American, that they were from the East Coast. And I think Lauren Fortgang especially, she sounds, that's how Ruth sounds in my head now. It's so strange when you've been reading the book aloud to yourself in your sort of Northern English accent, then you hear an American read it for the first time and read it smoothly and read it so that it flows in the way that the dialogue would flow if it was those people speaking it. Yeah, I remember hearing a sample of the audiobook and Ruth's voice just came out of my headphones. It was so incredible to hear her alive, to hear my character come to life like that.
Thanks to Emma Flint, Little Deaths is out now in paperback, ebook, and as a commercial audio download. Let's hope it finds its way into the RNIB library soon.